The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. And this is the History of the World podcast, unscripted. Hello everyone, welcome once again to another History of the World podcast, unscripted, with me, Chris Hasler, and this is the usual thing that we do between volumes, is publish a weekly episode of unscripted and unrelated stuff, so we can just keep in touch with one another. It's going to be another couple of months before the fourth volume of the podcast is officially launched. This week I thought I would go back to introducing one or two spoilers related to the material that you can expect to hear in Volume 4. Now, a couple of weeks ago I did introduce the fact that we would be introducing the rise of the Islamic Caliphates and the timeline of the Byzantine Empire until their ultimate convergence at the fall of Constantinople, where one would survive and one would not. But, of course, the Islamic world, started by Arabs, the actual conflict between the Byzantines and the Islamic world was actually the Turks. So the Turks came in and pushed the Arabs out, and they were actually the ones who came into direct conflict with the Byzantines on that fateful day in 1453. But, of course, that also bypasses somewhat another very important time for the Turkic Muslims when they had to defend Jerusalem from Christian crusaders. And that happened before the fall of Constantinople. So, After we've done the timeline of the Byzantines, we're going to go back to European history, and that will ultimately converge with the Crusades. So in getting to that point, we have to bring Europe from the fall of the Western Roman Empire right up until the 11th century. So initially, we'll be picking up the story from where we left it in Volume 3. So we saw that Southern Europe was dominated by Gothic peoples, and they were the main beneficiaries of the fall of Western Rome, with the Visigoths taking advantage of their opportunities in Iberia, in the lands of the modern country of Spain, and the Ostrogoths were able to take advantage of a bit of a power vacuum in the Italian peninsula. So they managed to get a foothold there. But of course, as we explored in Volume 3 as well, we were aware that the Byzantines, the Eastern Roman Empire, did endeavour to muscle into the Italian peninsula again. They managed to take lands of North Africa and really get themselves into a good position to invade the Italian peninsula again, but certainly it seems that the people of the Italian peninsula were quite indifferent to the interference of the Eastern Romans, much as there was much in the way of Roman culture still existing. Eastern Romans were very much Greek speakers, and by this time were somewhat culturally different. So for them, when the Lombards came into Italy in the aftermath of the Ostrogothic rule, and when the Byzantines managed to displace the Ostrogoths in Italy, the Lombards came in, and certainly there did seem to be some indifference really by the people of the Italian peninsula about whether they would be sort of subject to the Lombards or the Eastern Romans. There really didn't seem to be a lot of traditional Roman loyalty there. So when the Lombards ultimately succeeded, they managed to sort of stay put for a while, It was actually the Carolingians who overthrew them ultimately. And of course, when talking of the Carolingians, we have to follow that timeline from Volume 3, where the Carolingians, of course, were of French origin. And this is when we look back on what the origins of France from Volume 3 were, the Franks. And the Franks basically became more and more powerful within the lands of France. And ultimately, one of their more famous rulers was King Charlemagne. And he was very much we could call a figurehead for the Carolingian Franks and Carolingian France. And so we have to sort of follow that timeline as well of the preceding Merovingian dynasties and then ultimately the successful Carolingian dynasties. Also, when talking of France moving into the Middle Ages, you can't ignore the politics of Northwest Europe. And when I talk of Northwest Europe, I'm talking very much about the Vikings. And the Vikings play a very important role in European history at this point. So none more so than in the politics of the British Isles, which the Vikings showed a great interest in. And by this time, the British Isles, in the absence of the Romans, had been dominated by Germanic peoples who had crossed over the North Sea and began to settle these lands. And we know this period as Anglo-Saxon England. And so we'll be looking at the Anglo-Saxons. And we'll also be looking at the Viking invasions of Anglo-Saxon England, the British Isles, and certainly they did move over to Iceland and Greenland and even reached parts of North America. And of course, they didn't stop there. They went into the lands of France, the traditional lands of the Franks, and they actually ended up being granted a great portion of land where they, a branch of them became the Normans. And so we'll be looking at Norman history. And of course, with Norman history, it's not just the conquest of England, which sort of saw the end of Anglo-Saxon and Viking periods of British history, or English history, as we could call it back then. But also, we see the Normans venturing into the lands of the Mediterranean as well. So they were quite an international group, the Normans. And we always focus very much on the Battle of Hastings, but of course there's a wider story to the Normans, and their origination was from the Vikings, as was the first Russians, really. So the first Russians out of the city of Kiev were the Kievan Rus, and that was also a Viking migration that was the fundamental beginnings of that period of Russian history. And so we'll be exploring all of that. In exploring all of that, it's going to be unignorable to look at the Christianization of many of these cultures. So we look at certainly the Anglo-Saxons, the Carolingians, the Lombards. All of them experienced a Christianization process. And so we have to look at the religious identity of Europeans back then, and also how the art of feudalism came to pass. And the feudalism wasn't necessarily a new thing, but it was a means of political control of the land by granting land to fiefs, as you could sort of fiefs of land to to rulers who would then grant military service to the king. So he wouldn't, the monarchy wouldn't have to govern their remote lands directly. They could just install someone to operate the fief and then commit to mainly military offerings to the king himself. So we have to look at that, as it's a very important part of European politics around this time. So we'll be looking more closely at that too. Now, this is quite interesting for Europe, because all of these things sort of go hand in hand, and there's a progression. And so these fiefdoms, this feudal system, served to look after this new attitude in Europe, whereby many European peoples looked towards the bishops of Rome, the popes, for advice and for approval, if you like. And certainly if you was a king of a country, to have papal approval was a very important thing. And this meant that the popes became very powerful and also very military. We see the pope in the modern age as often an elderly man living in the Vatican City and making state visits and that kind of thing, in a very peaceful manner. It certainly wasn't the case 1,000 years ago. The Pope was very much involved in military decision making, and this led to the conflict when the Turks invaded Jerusalem. There was great horror amongst the Christian societies of Europe in terms of dealing with that. Originally, the first Islamic caliphates were quite religiously tolerant, and the Turkic Muslims were certainly not, and they were very interested in making Jerusalem an Islamic city strictly. And this upset the popes and so led into the age of the Crusade. So all of this and many of the battles surrounding that will be explored in Volume 4. So it will be a very dramatic and a very emotive experience for many of the nations and peoples of both Europe and Asia during this time. So that's a little spoiler as to another batch of the podcast that you can expect, another batch of episodes that you can expect to hear about in Volume 4. It will be, it will no doubt, be extremely interesting indeed. So I'm going to move on to some listener messages now. And Priyank Sharma, who's a History of the World podcast Illuminati member, has put, could you help me understand your perspective on something that I've been thinking about for a while? Do you think there's this massive black hole in ancient history that we know nothing about? That history is written mostly by the elite, who are never more than 5%, and the victors. And there's a large part of history we know simply nothing of, since there survive no written records of the 95% of the population who weren't rich, didn't build large temples, mansions, left behind no artwork, and just do not figure in the list of famous personalities. I ask this in the context of Persian and Indian history in particular, but also history in general. Is the story of humanity missing a crucial element? Just want to know what you think about it. Thanks for your time reading my message. What a difficult question to answer. Very difficult question to answer indeed. Well, yes, I, to be fair, I do believe that there's a lot more to find out, but whether we will ever find out about it or not, who knows? It really is just the case of uncovering archaeological sites. So I mean, for example, if you go back maybe 200 years, we would have had very little, if not any, knowledge of anything that went on at places such as Mohenjo-Daro, for example. I think that's a good example in the context of what you're referring to. I think it might be naive to think that there was like nothing going on in the Indus Valley after the Harappans moved on and before the arrival of the Aryans. It's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, in terms of black holes in history, I think everyday life, I think we can get some sort of perspective from archaeology about everyday life. So, for example, in Dark Age Greece, for example, where there's no writing, we're figuring things out through archaeological evidence. You know, the pottery gives us huge clues about the fact that there was a dip in organised society and that city-states then re-emerged, and then the written evidence supports that. So it's really like fitting together the pieces of a jigsaw. But I tend to look at other things, and like I think you stumble across things that make you ask questions. As a historian, you stumble across things. And so, for example, I'm going to go to a completely different era now, prehistory. When they made discoveries of Homo sapiens remains, or what they believe to be Homo sapiens remains in Morocco, that were 300,000 years old, which that was a recent event, maybe last year, I think. It made us question everything we knew about the history of Homo sapiens, which is always traditionally thought of as being in the Great Rift Valley. But from my perspective, this could be a trick of history. This could be a trick of the earth. If I do certainly believe that Homo sapiens emerged in Africa and migrated out of Africa. I believe that that is the case. However, to say that they emerged in Ethiopia or they evolved in Ethiopia and Kenya and Tanzania or any of that area might be missing the point that the Great Rift Valley is very, very good conditions for the preservation of fossilised human bones. If you get a substantial amount of rainfall, the substance of the earth lends itself to the preservation of bones much better than, say, the arid desert, where the bones will perish. They would absolutely just perish and we have nothing left. So the fact that the conditions suit the preservation of bones could almost be like a trick of saying that, well, this is the only place we found them, therefore it must have evolved there. And I think perhaps maybe they didn't evolve there at all. It's just that the remains were able to remain in that area of Africa and not in other areas. So, maybe I'm wrong. It's just one of those things that when I read about it, it crossed my mind. So, but an interesting question, Priyank, and I do think that I definitely believe that more archaeological discoveries, which inevitably will be found, will cause us to question the history that we already know. I firmly believe that, and certainly, over the course of the next 100 years, technology will advance to the point where we can discover more and discover it more easily, and we can certainly change our perspective on history. I think, if you read books that are 50 years old, though, our opinion now hasn't changed dramatically. So we haven't, it tends to just enhance, with new discoveries enhance what we already know. I certainly do believe, Priyank, that there will, even in the next 10 years, we'll be learning new things about various different cultures, and that will be based on discoveries, archaeological discoveries, and the most wonderful thing is when we discover texts that actually tell us what was going on. So yes, Priyank, I think there are black holes in history, if you like to call them black holes, where information is missing or lost. But you know, where they are, what they are, and from what age is anybody's guess. Now then, I got a very lovely message from Rene Razanen, who's put, glad to be on board with your wonderful podcast, Chris. I'm really looking forward to the episode about Iceland. My family and I relocated to Iceland, me from Canada, my husband from Finland, in 2012. Keep up the great work and thank you for sharing your passion with the rest of us. Well, Rennie, you mentioned an episode about Iceland. I actually alluded to this. This is a special episode. It's not strictly about Iceland, but it's about an aspect of Iceland. It's about an individual. But I'm not going to reveal too much at this stage. The reason why I'm making this episode is because for those members of the History of the World podcast Illuminati who make financial contributions to the podcast, when they reach a particular threshold, I invite them to suggest a topic for a half-hour episode. And I've actually written the episode now, so I know that it's good to go. I've just got to plan on when I'm going to publish it, but it will certainly be before the launch of Volume 4. And it is very intriguing. It relates to Norwegian politics as well, and it's very much firmly from the Middle Ages. So I think it's one to look forward to. It's very much off on a tangent, and it's just strange actually, because one of the other special episodes we did was about the House of Vasa, which is also very strongly related to Scandinavian politics. So it's just strange, isn't it, that we're going back to the Scandinavian lands and the Nordic lands once again. So but yes, hopefully that will be an enjoyed episode. When I talk of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, of course I mean those people who make monthly donations to the podcast. You can make financial contribution to the podcast, and it's always very welcome. It does help me to continue to produce podcasts of good quality, and helps me to buy resources, reading material, and podcasting equipment, and it's all gratefully received. And in return, I send you gifts and opportunities, and you become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati. And this week I will welcome Judith Sheffer, Kimberly Schluter, Kevin Talbot, and Rene Razanen, who of course sent that last message. Let's read some reviews out this week. We've got 10 out of 10 best history pod from Teddy Collects in Canada, who's put, as a student with an anthropology major and history minor, this is by far my favourite podcast to listen to. Upon listening, you can tell Chris cares not just for the sound quality and experience, but also the accuracy of the information given. 10 out of 10 would recommend this to anyone with interest in history or anthropology. Thank you very much, Teddy Collects. Aliador 77 from Romania. Fantastic. We've got a review from Romania. Has put, love it. I was looking for something like this. I started listening to it in 2020. Can't keep away from it. I work long hours. This is the highlight of my day. And finally, we've got a review from Australia from Drip, 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 Drop, who's put, can't think of a better way of living through a pandemic, COVID-19, than to listen to Chris. I'll be honest, when I first started listening, his English accent made me think of Monty Python. But it's a brilliantly researched podcast covering everything you ever wanted to know about how humans got where they are today. Fascinating stuff. Thank you, Chris. Definitely worthy of 5 stars and then some. Well, as ever, I'm always humbled by how how generous everyone is with their comments, and really quite it blows me away. I don't know what to say, and it's quite, you know, it's borderline embarrassing reading them out sometimes because they're just too kind. But I do like to give you the respect you deserve for taking the time and effort to write such kind things about the podcast. So thank you. Well, that's it for another week. I'm not sure what's going to be coming up next week. I think we're still probably a couple of months away from the launch of Volume 4. I think maybe October's probably realistic. I will still keep broadcasting every week and giving you spoilers for Volume 4 and maybe covering topics that maybe I felt should have been given a little bit more attention during Volume 3. Until that time, don't forget to rate and review the podcast if you enjoy it. And obviously, as ever, make sure that you endeavour to be good.
Come to the History of the World podcast.com and join all the other hot worlders on our wide range of social media. Why not support the podcast by clicking the Patreon link or buying me a book and becoming a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati? Drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com and let me know what you thought of this week's episode. See you next time.